Want to hear an amazing story? Back in 1960, Coach Brooks was on the Olympic hockey team. But a week before the games, his coach cuts him and sends him home. And that team went on to win the gold medal without him.
Herb Brooks had given up his dream of Olympic glory until 20 ordinary kids.
Why'd you want to play hockey?
Isn't it obvious? For the girls?
Gave him a second chance.
The Soviets win. My goal is to beat them at their own game.
Beat the best team in the world.
Gold medalists in 64, 68, 72, 76.
Name?
Mark Johnson.
Buzzy Schneider.
Michael Ruzioni.
You're missing some of the best players.
I'm not looking for the best players, Craig. I'm looking for the right ones.
They were bitter rivals.
A lot of guys from Minnesota and Boston.
Yeah, that's gonna work.
But one coach had a plan to turn them into a team.
I got no time for quitters.
You want me to play, huh?
I want you to be a hockey player!
I am a hockey player!
Think that'll get them going?
Oh, yeah.
When you face the impossible...
Russians' main weapon is intimidation.
These guys ever smile?
They're Russians. They get shot if they smile.
And you refuse to give up.
I didn't think it was gonna be this hard.
Yeah, you did.
We start becoming a team right now.
Miracles can happen.
When you pull on that jersey, the name on the front is more important than the one on the back.
Michael Ruggioni.
Who do you play for?
I play for the United States of America.
Welcome to the Olympics, gentlemen.
Walt Disney Pictures presents...
This is something that this country is ready for.
Great moments are born from great opportunity. If we played them 10 times, they might win 9, but not this game.
Listen to them. We can beat these guys.
Discover the story.
This is your time.
Behind the greatest moment in sports history.
Welcome to No Escape from Kurt Russell on the Siskoid Cinema feed, the show that explores the filmography of Kurt Russell and his mystique. I'm Siskoid. The Kurt Russell factor was billed to explain why there are performers. We will gladly see anything therein, regardless of the movie's synopsis. So we're testing out this theory that Kurt Russell is that kind of performer, film by film. And today we're going back to 2004 and the film Miracle. A sports biopic, Siskoid? Yeah, but Kurt Russell is in it. So to help me discuss this film is friend of the network and hockey announcer, DC Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Siskoid, and welcome to the Siskoid Cinema feed.
You're going
to
call it, and I'm doing color.
I'll do play-by-play, you do the color.
All right, we're going to talk about this. It's obviously a hockey film. that's the point here. But before we get into it, are you generally a Kurt Russell fan?
Yes, of course I'm a Kurt Russell fan. How can you not be a Kurt Russell fan? He is just one of those actors that you just seem to enjoy no matter what he's in. He's got an incredible range and brings a lot to every performance. And this movie, we'll get into it, of course, but this movie just exemplifies that.
You're right. He's always likable, even if he's playing what is possibly an unlikable character or an unlikable person in real life, as the hockey players who lived this story have told us. Is like, you know, he wasn't as nice as he seems in the movie. Which is interesting because every photo seems like very genial person, Herb Brooks here. But Miracle, is it a movie that you saw first run or at the movies or later? Where did you catch this?
I honestly don't remember where I caught it the first time. It was possibly in the theater. It was possibly on cable. I've seen it before, but it was kind of like in the back of my mind. So fresh rewatch that I did in prep for the podcast was fantastic. It was also nice because my son plays ice hockey, which is why I'm a little bit of the resident network ice hockey aficionado. And it was fun to watch the movie with my son. He's 12. He was really into the film. We had a great time.
Oh, that's cool. You watched it together. Yeah. I could be the aficionado, right? I'm Canadian. Should be in my blood, right? But it isn't. I don't watch hockey. I've watched it in the past. A couple of the Hohatmu girls are people I've lived with over the years, but Shotgun is the one who like really watched hockey, and it's like, okay, let's watch some hockey, you know. But I'm never really interested in, I don't like sports on TV is essentially it. I don't mind going to games in person, and then I have my own kind of fun, but I do find like, generally I find sports, televised sports, rather boring, but I do like them in movies, because in movies they cut out the boring parts, you know.
Well, that's very true. That's very true, especially in this film. There was not too much boring ice hockey in this film.
But a lot of hockey.
They're
on the ice a lot. You're seeing big parts of the games.
There was something like over 110 ice hockey plays that were run in this film.
Oof, yeah. No, it's, I think it is the, has holds a record for like the most, or at that time, the most feet of film shot for a Disney movie. Because there's so much, I mean, I don't even know how you put that stuff together to like replay plays that already exist, and then you're also using the real dialogue or the real announcer. Either it's the actual tape from back then, or he's redoing it for the movie, depending on the moment. You know, so you really have to do the same plays that occurred in real life if you want to. There are some differences, obviously, and you know, a lot of hockey experts, I'm sure there's a website that lists everything that is wrong or right about the portrayals, as with any biopic. But that's still a lot of hockey to cover on film. And using real actors, or what they did was take hockey players. They're like hockey players first, hockey players who can act rather than actors who can skate. So like the action is very real and immediate, and the camera's on the ice with them, you know. So it's a lot of movie to shoot.
Yeah, and the game of hockey is, you know, despite this being on film, you can set it up as much as you want. You can't tell the puck how to act.
You're right. It's gonna roll the way it rolls, right?
Exactly. And trust me, I've seen enough pucks go rolling in the direction opposite of where you want it to go to know that that's difficult. So kudos to the filmmakers for the, you know, amount of effort they put into the film to make this as exciting as they did and to make it as real as they did. I mean, we were on the edge of our seats. We know how this game is going to end, my son and I, and we were on the edge of our seats.
The Miracle on Ice that this covers, was this a, obviously, I don't know, we're a little too young, I will say, to have maybe watched it in 1980. I was 9, so there's no way, I wasn't aware of the Olympics. And also, I'm Canadian, so I would have cheered for the Canadian team, right? I wouldn't have been as invested in an American game, in the American underdogs. That wasn't on my radar. Was it on yours? Is this something like a hockey legend that, you know, is transmitted from hockey fan to hockey fan?
Yes. I mean, the Miracle on Ice is considered one of the most amazing sporting moments of all time. And for good reason, because I think as they set it up in those opening minutes of the film with the montage of going through the political climate from the 60s to the 70s, and those 15 years or so leading up to 1980, it kind of shows where U.S. hockey was at that time versus where it is today, which is it's an international game. You have players from all over the world. And, you know, in the 70s, there was the Iron Curtain. The Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc countries were off on their own. And so those players that are today in the NHL showcased as top players for Canada and for the U.S. were not players that we would have seen in the 70s.
They would have been amateurs. Like the movie does make that point that later they had dream teams and sort of critical of that, of bringing in professional, you know, athletes, whereas the Olympics are supposed to be for amateur athletes, so to speak, not professional ones. And if you're like outside the realm of the NHL, and you're not playing professionally because you're on the other side of the Iron Curtain, then these guys can be amateurs, you know, well into their 20s. Whereas in Canada and the US, you go pro relatively early. So, you know, this movie is really about university students.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the average age of that team, the Team USA in 1980, was 21. But meanwhile, some of those Russian players had played together for 15 years.
You know, they were playing on a professional level, going up against what would be amateur teams. And I say amateur sounds, I mean, it's non-professional, but it sounds more pejorative than I mean it to be, right? Before we go into it more deeply, let me just give a small synopsis of Miracle. We're going to spoil the heck out of it. So, you know, broadly, it goes like this. When college coach Herb Brooks is hired to helm the 1980 U.S. men's Olympic hockey team, he brings a unique and brash style to the ice after assembling a team of hot-headed college all-stars who are humiliated in an early match. Brooks unites his squad against a common foe, the heavily favored Soviet team. This is based on the true Olympic story, which was dubbed by the media at the time as the Miracle on Ice. So this is straight up from, you know, IMDb or, you know, the back of a DVD or something. But I do take issue with the idea that they're all college all-stars necessarily. They're all good college players, but, you know, Herb makes a point that he doesn't want an all-star team. That an all-star team is filled with people who are stars and therefore cater to themselves. And that's not how you build a team. You can't have all your best scorers on the same team. It's not going to work, right? A team needs different elements. Because you're coming to this as a, you know, from a hockey fan's point of view. I'm coming to this, like, this was extremely relatable to me because of the coaching. It's a coaching movie. For a long time, I've coached improv, theater games. And the type of improv that we play here in French Canada is based on hockey. We've got the jerseys, we've got the referees, the penalties, the rink, the smaller, obviously, the announcers, the everything is supposed to emulate a hockey game. Let's make a game that looks like hockey, but of course, it's you do sketches and you get points, you know, from the public votes for whichever they like and whatever. But it is based on a hockey game. And I coached this, you know, and at the university level. So a lot of the things that come up in this movie from Herb are either things I have personally done or tap into some of the values that I don't care about winning in the same way because it's a show first, you know, but there's still a lot of stuff in there that is either things that I've done or things that I wish I could have gotten away with.
Well, that kind of reminds me of that scene in the film where Herb kind of berates one of the players who's hurt. This is in the game, I think, in Madison Square Garden, where player gotten hurt against the Russians,
yep.
Soviets, excuse me. And he kind of calls him a pansy and then walks out of the room after getting in a little bit of a verbal shouting match with him. And, you know, the assistant coach has to clean up, but he's got a smile on his face. You know,
right.
Here's where I got away with getting these guys to draw on something that they didn't think they had.
I did this. So this is one of the things I did. The situation is the same. It's like not the most important game, although in this case, it's like their first face-off, sort of unofficial face-off against the Soviets, which I think he's throwing them into the deep end of the pool just by organizing this match. I want them to see what this is before we get to the Olympics. It's dangerous because it could demoralize them, you know, and they could think, no, we're never going to win against these guys. And so it could have backfired.
Oh, yeah.
I don't even think it's that one. I think it's the match before or after that. I think when the injury happens is the first game we see of the Olympics, per se.
Oh, that might be. It was one of those two games.
It was against Sweden. And they have to come back from behind every time. And so that's part of the legend. But they're not playing as well as they should. And he goes in there and he angers them. And I remember, like, of course, my style is different. It's a different game as well. But this was like probably the best team I ever coached. The university, the nationals. My story takes place in the semifinals. In the semifinals, we're up against the University of Montreal. We're way better than they are. You know, we got their number one spot. They got in their number four. We're winning, but like 3-2 after the first period. There are two periods in these games. 3-2. And it's like, oh, we're getting, I don't know, we're not playing our best. And I told my players in the break, these guys are way under our level. It's a little bit like players are like saving up energy for the next games. Like there's no next game if you don't win this one is the thing. And I said something, it was a Star Trek reference. I said something like, all your phasers are set to stun, set to kill. And the game ended 7-2. So like 3-2, we were winning 3-2, but that's not a big enough gap for this particular game. And so we won it 7-2. Like they left nothing on the ice. Herb Brooks in the movie, and apparently all of this pep talk stuff is real. There are some elements that aren't, that are for the movie, but all of these elements are supposed to be real. Like he really said that. He really, you know, made these speeches. But one of the things he comes back to is that you can't leave anything on the ice. I mean, the way they frame it is that Herb himself was in the Olympic hockey team a few times, actually. They only mentioned the one in 1960. And in 1960, the coach took him off the team a few days before the Olympics, and they won the gold. He never accomplished this. Like, the teams didn't do so well after that. They don't say what happened, why he was pulled off the team, but it seems that in the way that he speaks to his kids, he kept something in reserve. He didn't give the 110%. He left something on the ice. He regrets it. So it's about regret. Like, whatever you do, and this is something that I teach my kids, is whatever you do, it doesn't matter if you win or lose. That's out of our control. There's a lot of things that are out of your control. Penalties and the other team. That's all out of your control. And in our case, the public who are voting and giving the points, out of your control. What is under your control is the performance that you give, whether athletic or artistic. If you leave anything on the ice, if you're not fully committed, if you have regrets later, that's gonna stay with you, no matter what. So even if we lose, if you gave everything, then you have nothing to regret. But it's that regret that'll kill you. And I think that's what Herb feels, even though they don't really put a name on it.
No, and I don't think they necessarily need to. I think they did convey that message pretty well, because you do hear Herb talk about that in numerous different places in the film. And it's a great message that you gave to your team, and it's a great message that Herb is giving to his team. And I think with any kind of real life sports, no matter the level, I mean, this is something I talk about with my son, the ice hockey player, that I want you to never feel like you've left something. If you put it all out there, then you've done your best. And you can't do your best if you haven't put it all out there.
And this movie really is, it's about that. And it's also about acting like a team, rather than a bunch of hot dogs, you know, because that's like the main point of the first part of the film, where they're really, it's like he's always asking them, you know, their names and where they come from. And then who do you play for? And, you know, through the first act, they're always saying Boston, Mass, or whatever, you know, whatever it is. And it's only until, you know, at the point where one player, and this apparently did not actually happen, but at some point, you know, a player says, I play for the United States. And that's the moment where they stop being rivals and they're all in the trenches together at this point, especially since it's after he penalizes them after they lose that game in Oslo, where they're distracted. They're looking at girls in the stands. I think they tied that game.
They did.
Yeah, it's not great. And he forces them to do those, you know, back and forths on the ice.
They're called suicides.
Suicides, right.
And for a reason.
Yeah, but like he takes that too far, right? Like you see the doctor, the team doctor is a little ooh about it. And the assistant coach is certainly, like, he plays the empathetic coach, the friend to the players. And he feels really bad about, he has to blow that whistle over and over and over. And it's like, and Herb is just going again. And like when they're not doing it again, this is the bit where I wish I could have done stuff like this. You know, I've forced people to redo, you know, because for me, it's like hockey, there's strategy, right? So the coach is going, okay, let's do this. And the coach is part of the team in the game. In improv, that's not really, a lot of coaches do this where they're sort of controlling the game and giving ideas to players. I don't think that works. That doesn't work for me, especially university level. You train the chemistry, you train the teamsmanship, you force players into uncomfortable corners where they'll discover things about themselves. They become as universal a weapon as possible. And once you get to the tournament, you just let them play. You're on the bench making sure, you know, nobody jumps in at the last, when there's only 10 seconds left or something, you know, but my players are supposed to be complete. They don't need me once we get there. So it's a very different game. So I've done stuff like, okay, let's run it again. Let's try it again. Let's try another idea on the same theme, and another and another and another. I'm well known as the person who makes the improvs too long. So when the improv is obviously over, I will let them stew in that moment. There's another 2 minutes. And once they get to those 2 minutes, and I think there's another minute, and forcing them to find, there's more and more improv, right? It's like, stop giving me your ideas and get to that point where you have no idea left and you have to improvise. So this is kind of similar, you know, how do you push players? What is too far? What isn't far enough? This is a good movie about that. And if we get into a little bit of Kurt Russell here, like, he's very good at playing the hard ass, which this obviously needed, but also giving that hard ass a humanity and the likability. But like I said earlier, like the real players did not like Herb Brooks. And he didn't go to their Christmas parties like they show in the movie or anything. So those moments, how do you do that? Like, he's destroying his marriage on the side. You know, like, sure, Patricia Clarkson is in the stands at the end and she's super happy. But during the movie, we're seeing how this is taking a toll on his family, that his obsession with the winning the Olympics, or at least doing well against the Soviets. I mean, I'm not sure where the ambitions are, you know, at all times. It's like, well, we'll do our best, but to get our best, I will be obsessed. It's a line to thread to portray someone who is likable, despite the fact that he is doing unlikable things.
Absolutely. I think this is a very human film. It was very relatable on multiple levels, like you've just highlighted. Kurt does a fantastic job of humanizing Herb. I mean, he could have been a machine. He could have been portrayed as the likable person where the wife falls into line and the players fall into line and everybody is just happy for him and they all get behind him. But no, there's a lot of conflict in this film, which, you know, conflict makes good drama. But you're right. When you're trying to portray somebody that is not necessarily liked by a lot of people. I mean, Herb had a lot of adversity and people against him. You know, the committee was not happy with him for the way he chose the team. The committee didn't necessarily even want to give him the job to begin with. There was a lot of convincing that had to be done on that end. His wife was, like you said, the marriage was definitely stressed in that time. And that's tough. I've been married for a very long time. I don't know that my wife would necessarily be happy with me for 9 months being so super obsessed with something that I basically live and breathe that and that only. Because I can't even see how Herb's life could be anything other than that, considering what his ultimate goal was. I think, though, that seeing those moments, like him going back to watching the film after getting in a fight with his wife and being distracted by what just happened, turning it off, going back in and having a talk with her. And then, you know, missing the press conference so that he could watch his kids skate and he could drink coffee with his wife. And yeah, he's still in the moment of who am I pairing up with who? And he tells her that. But you could see that even their relationship had grown, because at that point she's like, okay, I get it. But he's also here with me. So, but I mean, that is also not necessarily very likable, you know, that you don't necessarily want to be second fiddle to anything. And here, his family's having to play second fiddle to this team and this obsession of his. And it's not just for a week or two. It's for a good part of the year.
All right. And he would go on to coach other Olympic teams in the future. You know? So, but maybe the pressure's off once the miracle is accomplished, as they call it, right?
Right.
Yeah. And Kurt Russell really, probably there's some manipulation in the script, I'm sure. I'm sure not, you know, who knows how some of these things played out for real.
Right.
But I imagine that he wasn't at a particular press conference. I like the bit where the reporters ask him if he's making sure that the players aren't asked questions. Journalists don't have access to the players. They don't even have access at first to the assistant coach. They're going, oh, are you just trying to keep the spotlight on you? And there's some hubris there, I'm sure. But at the same time, I completely agree with this decision to prevent the players from becoming these sort of media starlets. It's enough that they see the telegrams that they've received and the well-wishers and, of course, the crowd's energy when they're actually playing. But it's so easy for, especially a young man that age. I've seen it a lot. When they know some success and they get some a little bit of groupie action and stuff like that. And, of course, for us, it's comedy rather than sports. But it's the same idea. Their heads swell up. They become a lot more difficult to coach. They start acting on egotistical impulses. That can break up a team. That can cause problems within a team and break up its chemistry. So to keep them away from all of this nonsense is a good idea. And so I feel like, yes, you can see it as it's his ego and he's the one going for the medal. It's his story and he knows it, you know, that kind of thing. But also, I think he's taking a bullet for them. He has to deal with this nonsense. And we've seen Herb throughout the film. I'm sure he'd rather be in a room somewhere watching tape of opponents playing than dealing with these reporters. There is a sacrifice there for him that he's making, I think. But perhaps I'm projecting. because I would also try to protect my players from this kind of stuff and also would not like to be doing the face stuff.
No, I agree with you 100%. I think, I mean, sure, there is probably a little bit of hubris there, and let's just focus on me and what I'm trying to accomplish with this team of nobodies, right? These are not known people to the or known players to the general public. But I think you're right. I think there's a opportunity for misplaced confidence in a player that becomes a media darling. And I think the opportunity to take that bullet for the team, you know, goes back to what he was trying to accomplish in that first act, you know, with those suicides after that game against Norway, right? He wants them to be a team. And they even say to him when he's getting it down to that last couple of players and he brings that other player in for a couple weeks, they confront him and say, look, we're a family. This is the family we want to take to Lake Placid. He's recognizing and enabling them to remain a team and not let any one person stand out. And there were plenty of standouts on that team, but there's time for that after the Olympics, not here in this moment, not if they're going to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish.
Right. And there's every reason to believe that he brought in a ringer just to make them act like this.
Nervous.
Yeah, make them nervous. And I've seen this a lot as well in improv. It's like when I'm building my all-star team, I start with, for us, it's like six players, okay? Six to eight because there's two alternates, two subs. And I start with 12. Four will be cut in the first semester. You know, I recognize the moment where he does cut a player, where we see him, where he cuts a player and the player is very grateful to have been given a shot. That's the attitude you want from a player. You know, that's a player you want to pick up again next year. But you do have players who take it very badly. That's your job to cut people. So I became very ruthless, a bit like this. But the idea that while the team has not been picked, there is competition between them. And they're not acting like team players. And some of them, it sinks some of them. And then they don't get picked. And they don't know why they didn't get picked. But they didn't get picked because they couldn't get their head around the idea that we're a team. Yes, it's a team of 12 when it'll eventually be a team of 8 or a team of 6 on the bench. You have to have that attitude from the beginning. And a lot of people feel threatened, like these kids here. They feel threatened by others. It's like, well, I'm one of the newbies, and so I'm against all the other newbies. I've got to compete against that person. To me, that's what sinks them.
Yeah.
So the fact that these guys, you know, chose to represent themselves as a group and close ranks, you know, it's like showed the coach something there, that they belonged on the line. You know, it's a permutation on the same idea.
Well, and you know, I'm going to say that it's a very human nature thing to be competitive even amongst your teammates. And it's something that has to be taught, like you're saying, that you need to be a team first. You know, obviously you see it at every level. I'm seeing it with 11 and 12 year olds that are being competitive with one another, claiming they're the best player. Now, none of these kids are ever going to go to the NHL, and none of these kids that I see are the next Wayne Gretzky. But some of them can be very competitive with one another. And, you know, I don't know if it's learned traits from their parents or if this is something that just naturally happens. I think it's probably a little bit of both, but it's in that same vein. And what I tell my son is he's stepping into a leadership role this year on his team because he's now a 12-year-old. I've reminded him that, look, you know, last year you weren't fond of your teammates basically telling you you suck, right? So your job, if you're going to be in a leadership role and really want to bring this new team that you're on together, is to step up and be supportive of your fellow teammates and be a leader for them and show them that there's always give them positive feedback, always help them. Don't ever tell them they suck or don't ever push them down because you need them to be the best that they can be when you're in a game. You can't just turn it on and off like that. And pushing individuals away during practice will just get them to be pushed away when you really need them to be on your side. So definitely that whole idea of we need to be a team. We need to be a team together. We need to be a family. That's a great message that comes out of this film. And I love that they were able to do that. Maybe not as storybook as that in real life, but I'm hopeful that that's a little bit of how it worked in real life in 1979, 1980.
From what I've read, the players who lived it said like most of the dialogue is almost verbatim what they remembered from the event. Some of the differences that they do mention is that when they stopped doing the suicides, it wasn't because a player said, a player really broke down. Like in the movie, they made the players do that. The actors do it. When we see them exhausted and puking, and that's real. So they were put through the ringer as well. But of course, living it would have been like just one night, not a series of days of shooting.
Right.
Would have been really bad. So the like moments like that tell you that Herb Brooks was, you know, a real slave driver. He was tough, probably beyond what was reasonable. I'm also told that they cleaned up his dialogue because this would have been the bluest Disney movie ever made. That's normal in those kinds of environments, right?
Yeah, well, I have 12-year-olds. Trust me, they have hockey nuts.
Yeah. But essentially, a lot of the pep talk, a lot of the events, obviously when they replay the games play out as they did. The Olympics are a documented event. I was also surprised, although when I looked into it, you know, I realized, okay, yeah, there is no final with the medal. But it did seem weird that, you know, it's like, okay, we're going to concentrate on the game with the Soviets at the end. And there's a lot of, I don't know, it feels like you're an hour in that one game. A bit less than that, but it's still a lot. So you're really seeing how that game is playing out, which is very interesting. But it's like the first game in the medal round. It's not a final, which normally would be a final. And then we're told, we also won the next game. And then that gave us the gold medal. And so, that's a little atypical. But looking into it, it's like when you got the medal round, there were two pools, and the first and second place of each pool went up against the teams in the other pool. And then whoever made the most points, you know, based on how they calculate that, gets the gold medal, which the States did get. And then the Soviets were second, you know, got the silver medal, even though they lose here. So it's a points game, or it was. I don't know how it still works in the Olympics today, but, you know, it wasn't elimination rounds. There's not like a gold versus silver, like who gets the gold and the silver at the end. So now I understand why that was. And of course, the game against the Soviets, that's your major obstacle. That's what we call, in improv, we call it the real final. It's like whenever you're in the semifinals and you're really against the best team, and then, you know, the other pool kind of produces a lesser matchup, and then your final is going to be kind of easy, kind of boring. When the two best teams somehow wind up in semifinals, that's the real final. So this is what happens here, you know. And I think you're talking a lot about like the leadership and getting these lessons across. Let's bring it home. Kurt Russell, he's the kind of person that in a movie you gravitate to and like who has that authority. And we mentioned this when we talked about Tombstone and to a point Stargate, that when he's in a film, you believe what he says. You know, he's a leader on and off the screen. And like he's shown this, like I read some nice trivia where he took a pay cut to make sure that the extras in all the fans in the hockey games could get a hot meal rather than, you know, like a brown bag lunch. Extras aren't necessarily always given much respect. So doing things like that shows a leadership that is outside of the ice, if you will, off the screen. He's that kind of person as well. I think that likability and that natural leadership that we see in his characters are also part of his true self when I read stories like this.
Yeah, I have to think so. I also saw that, you know, Herb Brooks is left-handed and that Kurt is right-handed. So during the film, he performed left-handed. And so to me, that commitment to a detail that I wouldn't have noticed that. I don't know that 99.9% of people would notice that. But that level of commitment to the character and the story can only translate to, you know, a leadership type role. I mean, you're saying, look, I'm committed to this. I need you to follow me in this commitment. You want to. You're inspired to follow this actor into this commitment to perform, you know? And so then that's what makes, I think, Kurt really good in this role is that commitment, because then, especially using hockey players as actors, right? You want to give your best, not just show up, because he could have easily just shown up. You know, he could have shown up, done his thing. But I mean, this is this is a Kurt Russell movie. I mean, there is no doubt that this is a Kurt Russell movie. I don't know that there are many scenes that Kurt is not in, if any.
There's one in a bar. There's a couple of things. Generally, he's there. And you're right, he has to inspire. I know that scene where they say we're a family, that was the very first thing they shot because the kids were so intimidated that it would play well. that they had to confront their coach. And that's their first scene. And so their nervousness. So I think the director was, some of them have never played in a movie before, essentially a lot of non-actors, and making them perform, you know, giving them like a boost that use your own real emotion. Like, this is really happening. So you just react how you would, whether it's doing those suicides, whether it's confronting the star of the film in the first thing you do, you know. I really appreciate like that fidelity. And then right-handed, left-handed, we would never, no, I, not that I knew enough about the man, you know, the real Herb Brooks, but it's still a real commitment to, like, when we think of Kurt Russell, because he's been in some action films and he has a sort of persona, there's a tendency to think, well, he's a movie star rather than an actor. The difference I make is that an actor can disappear inside the role, whereas a movie star is usually themselves in another situation. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he's a sheriff. It's Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he's, you know, stuff like that. He's a movie star more than an actor. I'm not saying they're not actors as well. Kurt Russell is definitely an actor, and it's moments like this where, I mean, the Minnesota accent that he affects, this part of it where he's like almost method with the left-handed thing. I do think of him as an actor who is also like a famous face, who is also a movie star, but he's a lot closer to the middle on that scale, on that spectrum.
Yes. And I would say, I think the difference between a movie star and an actor as well is, do you get lost in the performance? Or are you constantly reminded that this is Arnold Schwarzenegger on the screen? And for me, yes, I think it is somewhere in the middle. Yeah, I remembered it was Kurt Russell, but I got lost in the performance many a time in this film and saw Herb Brooks. And that to me is a quality performance when I can put aside the known quantity of who is performing and just watch the performance.
So when all is said and done, let me use the, we talked about Arnold, the podcast, the La Vista Baby summation, and ask first, is Miracle a good movie?
Yes, it's a fantastic movie.
I think it's a pretty great movie myself. My introduction at the beginning said sports biopic, because that does, you know, I'm not a sports person, which doesn't mean I can't enjoy sports movies. But biopics are like my least favorite genre. So that's why I put it that way. In this case, it's a great underdog story. It's a great sports movie. It's a great coaching movie. Even the fact that it's like patriotic, you know, it is set up to talk about an America that is, you know, that malaise speech by Jimmy Carter, right? It's an America that has lost faith. And this is painted as a moment where, okay, we pick ourselves up. Like, America needed a miracle to revive its own spirit. That's how they play it, by using the various current events of that last decade or so. Obviously, as a non-American, that doesn't necessarily affect me in the same way. But the way that it brings it to some sort of universal coaching, sporting spirit, the idea, I think makes it a good film. Yeah, a good sports movie, a good, I'm sure it's a good biopic. That's the bit I don't really care about, you know, that it really happened, or obviously it feels like it really happened, but nevertheless, keeps you on the edge of your seat the way the action is shot. And so it feels exciting, even though maybe you know the outcome.
My son and I watched it knowing what the end result was going to be, but that didn't stop, you know, my hockey player sitting there saying, oh my God, look at that play. Oh, that pass was incredible. And he really appreciated the realism of that film and the story and the message. But I mean, the hockey action was fantastic. There were times, you know, where I don't know if it's a good biopic or not, but I mean, it did feel like it could have been a story and not a real event. That kind of puts it in the middle. It's a little bit unique. And maybe that's why it's a miracle, right? It's because it transcends real life while at the same time being real life. So it's almost unbelievable that it happened. But like you said earlier, this is a well-documented event. I mean, there were times where Al Michaels is calling out the time in the game and they show the scoreboard, and the scoreboard is showing that. And we know that's the actual things that Al Michaels said in that moment, whether it was the recording or the re-recording of those lines.
Just using his voice or the voices of the different Ken Dryden and using the actual voices of the people who called the game, like those voices are iconic to anyone who's ever watched hockey. I'm sorry. You know, it's like we also have an equivalent in French Canada who I just can't stand, but it's like that's iconic voices that through our youth, and they may have changed since then because, I mean, okay, we're getting up there. But, but you know, those voices are quite recognizable and it feels like I'm really watching it. And in fact, you kind of are. You are watching real hockey players, real hockey action. They're trying to redo plays that actually happened, but it's kind of like watching a real game. It's a little more immediate, fewer breaks, et cetera, to make it more exciting, obviously. But you know, you get to the right to the moments. So yeah, I think it's a good movie on all those metrics. Now, is Miracle a good Kurt Russell movie?
I would say yes. I would say this film, first of all, marks his return to Disney. It had been nearly 30 years since he had been in a Disney film. I think this film just explores his talent and really gives him an opportunity to shine.
One of the things I neglected to mention at the top of the show, I asked you how you came across this film, and I didn't answer the question for myself. If a Kurt Russell movie is a good Kurt Russell movie is a movie I want to see because Kurt Russell is in it, regardless of what the content is. This is one of those because I bought the DVD blind based on, oh, Kurt Russell is in it. And I do like hockey action in movies, you know, that's sure. But if it was anyone else, this is not a movie I would have sought out. So there you go. You know, and I mean,
yeah.
He makes that checkered, those checkered clothes. 70s clothes, really iconic, I feel. Like the checkered jacket and later it's checkered pants. Such so of the era, and he makes that iconic. It's like I'm in that moment, and the performance is still different enough from other performances that you can tell, yes, it is a specific character, you know, unlike the characters that he's played before or since. He's so on point with that particular person, the real person, and trying to inhabit that person's clothes and skin.
I agree. Let me take just a second to mention how well they made this a period piece. What seemed like no effort. I felt like it was 1979 and 1980. I mean, the cars, the clothing.
The hair.
The checkered suits, the hair. Oh, my God, the hair. I loved his hair in this movie. It was so perfectly 79 hair. It was fantastic. It was hard to take my eyes off that hair sometimes.
Kind of a Lego hair.
Yes, very Lego hair. But, I mean, it, just the Volkswagens in the background. Just everything was very on point.
So, well, thanks for indulging in some WrestleMania with me today, Dave. I hope you had fun with it.
I had a blast.
And I'm glad you made it like a family event where you could watch it with with your kid who is a hockey player. So I like that we got like a third opinion in our conversation thanks to that. So I'll let you go back into the theater. We'll play a trailer. And I'll be back for your feedback on our previous episode in which Shag and I discussed Stargate.
Saturn, who's there?
Hyperion to a Saturn.
Follow Siskoid's deep scene-by-scene dive into adaptations of Shakespeare's Hamlet on Hyperion to a Saturn, the Fire and Water Network's Hamlet podcast. To listen or not to listen isn't the question. Kenneth Branagh, Derek Jacobi, Mel Gibson, Laurence Olivier, Ethan Hawke, David Tennant, Classics Illustrated, and many more covered every episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com or where you usually get your podcasts.
Rest is silence.
There's no escaping your feedback on our previous episode in which Shag and I discussed Stargate. Let's start with Gene Hendricks. Says, you know what? I'm on Shag's side on this one. I also saw it in the theater. It came out in my freshman year in college, and I loved it. I immediately got the score on CD and listened to it almost as much as the 4-disc Star Wars set. I'm going to need to watch it again, but the last time I saw it was only a few years ago, and I still enjoyed it. The characters all have something to make them three-dimensional, even the background ones. There's also some real tension with the we can't get home and we can't let them go through plots. Could they have leaned less into the Kurt Russell-ness at the end? Yes, but I think it was a Jaws moment. We followed the character and cared about him that much, so that once we reach the end, we're cheering for him to be healed of his kids with guns phobia, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense. Gene hasn't seen the TV show, though. Bradley Glynn is the opposite, says the TV show was in syndication on free TV 1 year after they aired on Showtime, and that's how it grabbed me. Later, I was able to watch the current eps when the show moved to the Sci-Fi Channel, but I've never seen more than a few minutes of the original movie. Chris Franklin says, fun discussion. I saw the movie in the theater and enjoyed it, but I'm not sure I've seen it since. I've never watched any of the series. This despite the fact that my previous employer of 21 years donated a thermal imager to the crew, which was used on the show. They sent it back and a poster, both signed by Richard Dean, MacGyver, Anderson, who played Russell's role in the series. Lizanne Oswald says the movie is awesome and Kurt is great in it. The show was pretty good too. So it seems there's plenty of fans for this one, whatever I might have thought myself. Mike Thomas says, I've never seen this movie or the TV series, okay, but I enjoyed the discussion and always like to listen to this podcast. Kurt Russell was in his prime in the 90s, and that's my favorite decade for movies. Maybe because I was in my 20s then, and I saw more movies in the theater than at any other time in my life. I think some of the movies of the 90s were objectively some of the best and most fun. Chris Pine says, Stargate was one of those movies and franchises that just slipped by me. I remembered the images from the trailer and how cool I thought it looked, but I never checked it out. So I watched this one specifically for the podcast. That's my kind of fan. Thanks, Chris. And if I'm being honest, it was kind of tough to get through, and it took me a few days. I kept getting distracted because the film didn't really hold my attention. I know that ciphers and language and the power of the written word were important aspects of this film, but I found those scenes, when they try to communicate with the people who live in this world, very tedious. This was a really interesting role for James Spader, who I'm more used to seeing as a kind of self-serving yuppie or in something completely bonkers like Crash, the good one. So seeing him play the Rachel Weisz to Russell's Brendan Fraser was wild. And it was interesting to hear Shag give us some background information, especially how they changed some things with Jay Davison to make him appear more threatening, because I loved all the choices he made in this. He oozed sinister malice and contempt, while also having an almost feminine body language that gave him the sense of the kind of hubris a monarch like Ra needed in this film. The way he used his arms and how he held his head in some scenes was incredible. Seriously, one of my favorite portrayals of a sci-fi villain ever. The best thing in this movie, as far as I'm concerned, but this is a pod about Kurt Russell, and while Shag said he felt someone else could have played this role, I think it would have been a completely different film. An action hero from the early 90s, like Arnold, Van Damme, Seagal, or even Bruce Willis, probably would not have been able to make enough room for Spader to drive the first half of the film in the way Kurt did in this one. So while I did not really like this film, I would have to say it's a good Kurt Russell movie, simply because I'm not sure anyone else could have done it like he did. Ange says, I felt it desperately wanted to be an intelligent sci-fi movie, but it didn't get there. I also had a hard time with some of it. The people there have laser lances, but are startled by a cigarette lighter. I also think Russell's hair is modeled after Guile in the Street Fighter 2 game. I've heard that before. And Doug Adamson says, I have to say I'm firmly in the camp of Kurt Russell is brilliant in probably everything he does. He might have a bad film, but I've not seen it yet. I've read some Eric Von Daniken books or similar, Charles Berlitz, Graham Hancock, and others. I subscribe to the Fortean Times, not because I believe in any of the paranormal or ancient aliens, etc., but because I think we all need a sense of wonder about a world that seems now to be lacking thereof. After all, we've mapped out the world with satellites. We'd have found a Skull Island or an Atlantis, etc. Our understanding of physics precludes the concept of ghosts. Our understanding of biology precludes the concept of fairies, etc. But having that sense of what if, that sense of, well, maybe there's more going on here, allows us to sit back and enjoy what is glorious nonsense that is Stargate in all its forms. Doug enjoyed the SG-1 series, but he says the film itself is pure bunkum. I know they explained why they have big flying ships and Stargates, but honestly, I don't recall the excuse, and I doubt it holds up. But it plays straight, and it manages to stay on the right side of crazy theories. While Siskoid might despise Roland Emmerich, I love his work because it is utter nonsense from start to finish in every film, and I can enjoy the spectacle with my inner 10-year-old sitting there going cool. How Emmerich has not been tapped for a superhero film is beyond me. Emmerich works best with Dean Devlin, in my thinking, and I really hope the pair of them work together again, as they seem to have been able to keep the spirit of pulp action heroes and stories to the modern screens. I think their last collaboration was Godzilla, so I'm not sure I want to agree with you, Doug. So that's the bottom of the mailbag. Siskoid Cinema's No Escape from Kurt Russell is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. If you're listening to this and have your own opinions on what we've discussed, please feel free to head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com to leave a comment. I'll read them on our next episode. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/FW podcasts.